Welcome to episode 2, What Makes a Model Subject a Classic? Today we're looking at the kits and subjects that keep coming back, whether that be a Spitfire, a Tiger, Sherman Tank, and then we're going to ask, why do we keep building them, and what is it about these subjects that makes them timeless? So just thinking, when we actually look at the different subjects I'm thinking about, be it a Spitfire, Tiger 1, Mustang, Sherman, the Messerschmitt BF-109, T-34, FW-190, the Mitsubishi Zero, and of course, the Bismarck, not to leave ship modellers out. These subjects do seem to live forever in plastic, and they're often kitted and built quite a lot. And I just wanted to sort of use this episode to ask the question why, because I think there are a few reasons, and I think it's not just because they actually look cool or were effective in real life. I think a lot of it comes down to the myth, the marketing behind that myth, and also how it lives in our memory, because there's often a lot of examples that aren't necessarily the best at doing something or were most notable at doing the thing that they are known for doing, but they still capture the imagination. And that's what I want to get into. So let's look at some iconic subjects in history and link that to the modelling as well. So if we take the classic, the Spitfire, I mean, it does get the headlines, especially for Battle of Britain. You know, 1940, Britain up against it, fighting alone. But if we actually look at what was going on, it's a very well-known fact that the Hurricane, the Hawker Hurricane, was doing the heavy lifting early on, certainly in 1939 and into 1940. So during the Battle of Britain, the Hurricane made up a lot more numbers than the Spitfire did quite a lot of the kills in the air, was quicker to turn around when it actually needed to be refueled or reserviced or whatever it was. When it got on the ground to be ready to go back up in the air, was a much faster turnaround than the Spitfire. Yet the headlines of that certain particular battle, the Battle of Britain, we all think about a Spitfire. It did take over as the war progressed, so the Spitfire did sort of come into its own, especially into 1941 and into 1942, but it's lasted in popular culture. It's always been the Spitfire. You can kind of see why. You know, it is sleeker, it's more elegant, it looks like an actual thoroughbred fighter. It's got that image, and obviously taken with Churchill's famous quote of so much owed by so many in that speech, it is cemented in the history, both for modellers and the actual history. Again, if we look at the Tiger Tank, nearly every manufacturer has got a Tiger Tank model there. But in reality, it was quite rare. It's that old thing, every tank in Normandy in 1944 was a Tiger, but it probably turned out that it was a Panzer IV. Certainly earlier in the war as well, when we're in the East, you know, for every Tiger, there's probably five Panzer IIIs and Panzer IVs making up the difference. And they did most of the work on the ground. And I mean, even later on, we've got the Panther tank. It was far more prolific, certainly in the later battles, than the Tiger tank ever was. But it's the Tiger that captures the imagination. It was more terrifying. It had a reputation through Allied troops and in the Soviet troops. And anyone who came up against it, they were often afraid of it, or it became a kind of monster or a myth. It's probably that fear that made it live long in the memory. It made it a legendary subject, and obviously the hobby has carried that on forward with a similar thing. You know, so many manufacturers have these kits, and these subjects, it's not just the history where these subjects cut through, it is in our hobby as well. You know, they do strike a chord with us, they do capture the imagination, and you know, you can't blame nearly every manufacturer for having these same subjects, whether it be Airfix or Tamiya or Tacom. They all need to release their own versions, because if Airfix has got a Spitfire and Tamiya hasn't, Airfix's Spitfire is not making any money for Tamiya, so Tamiya need a Spitfire, and so on it goes. So, you know, if you're a new company and a young company, you need to start thinking about that. And to kind of flesh that out, we've got the sort of, you know, what's the business behind a classic? You know, it's model companies aren't just picking these to be necessarily historically accurate. They're looking for models that sell, certainly if they're young companies. I mean, take the example of Qatari. Massive backing coming in from the kind of Wingnut Wings idea, and got all of that behind them. But still, we've had a Spitfire, where they've now got a 109, they've announced that they're going to release a Hurricane. So these are very top subjects. You know, if you're into aircraft, Spitfire, Hurricane, Messerschmitt 109, I think that would be in the top three of most people if they were starting a company, because you know they're going to sell. It's guaranteed sales. It's going to get you what you need to then be able to grow out from there and maybe produce some more esoteric subjects or something a bit more niche. And these companies don't want to leave money on the table. So this is the point. You know, everyone needs to have these in their catalogue, and then growing out from there, they can start to do subjects that are a little bit more tricky from the sales point of view and get away with it. You know, if we all release niche subjects, we've seen companies come and go in the past when they start with very iffy releases. It's good to start with the heavy hitters, because, you know, no matter how niche the hobby gets, there's always new modelers, and many of them, you know, their first kit is going to be a Tiger, a Spitfire, and so on. You often see people kind of kicking off a little bit online, but I think it's worth taking on board why this is happening. And I think it's an interesting aspect to it as well. Another big part of it is the nostalgia. So when we get reach a certain age, and it's starting to hit me heavy as I reach the end of my 30s, nostalgia kicks in and comes into play. And with that, box art can do that as well. Now, historically, it's a bit before my time, but if we actually talk about how the box art can play a role, it can play a huge role, in fact. Because there's a whole generation that actually grew up with the Roy Cross paintings. A little bit before my time, I must admit, but, you know, I remember seeing them on the Airfix kits, and the ones that always sort of stuck with me was like the picture of the short Sunderland that was part of that kit. It was a niche kit, but the capturing of such an iconic image and that going on to the box art can propel those subjects into becoming classics. If you're into aircraft, a short Sunderland is a beautiful aircraft, but you'd probably have to say it's a little bit niche when you compare it to some others. But that has become a very, very classic kit. And it was because the artwork made you want to build it. And these are back in the good old days. We had a terrible period where the box art was just a badly built version of the model. But we seem to have got past that now in a number of ways. And the box art's, albeit it's digital, box art is playing a huge part in what's making people pick up kits. And everyone seems to be, you know, up in their game on that. You've still got classics that are kind of seemingly hand-painted, like even Tamiya box art still seems to be along that vein, and it's classic. But you've also got, you know, Airfix and Edward and people like that are bringing on digital art. It looks like a painting, but I think it's been done digitally. And then you've got Tacom and those sorts of ones as well that are now bringing in kind of like a mix, a hybrid. It looks as though it's in between. All of that can really help. And that's then cemented. If you look at Airfix now releasing the actual vintage classic range, which is bringing back some of these old kits. They may not be up to scratch, but they've got those old box arts. And it's almost about actually buying the package. You're not really buying it necessarily for the kit. It's to kind of relive that nostalgia. All that's kind of going around to make you remember, you know, rainy Saturdays, making models with your dad and messing about with the decals and getting the paint everywhere, enamel paint all over the place. But that's all part of what makes this hobby. It brings it together. That's my kind of introduction to this episode. And I think it's worth saying, you know, what was your first classic? My first classic is no surprise. I think I've mentioned it before. It was a Spitfire with my dad, and it's probably the same for a lot of you. And there's a reason behind that, and it's still, you know, in the starter kits or one of the first kits people buy. But I'd like to know what your first model was. What subject, you know, deserves the title of classic in your mind? It could be a Tiger, it could be a Mustang, something we've all built, or it could be something even a little bit more niche or more personal. So let me know in the comments. It'd be great to read through, and I'll be there reading through and commenting back to you and trying to get a conversation going there. Now, in the next segment, I've got this is legacy or nostalgia, why we keep coming back. So in this segment, I'd want to actually talk about something that affects a lot of us in this hobby, maybe without even realising it sometimes, which is kind of working on that nostalgia again, but versus the legacy. You know, why do we keep coming back to these same subjects that we're always so drawn to? And again, to reuse the Spitfire, the Tiger, and throwing in something slightly different is the Bismarck. There is a kind of nostalgic loop that we can kind of look at. And for many of us, it's we have that break from children. You know, we're building models and more like a sort of extension to toys. And then we're going in back into the hobby as an adult. And that nostalgia is usually what's kicking it off to pull us back in. It could be seeing a box art, like I'm saying, like one of the Roy Cross illustrations. Or even if you think about an aircraft, you come across an air show or something like that, or you're out and about. Again, I've said before, Spitfire's flying over me. I don't know how many I've seen. I think it's 7 now this year, and I haven't even been to an air show. So they're always around. That can capture the imagination. Me, I've done videos on this in the past as well. It's looking at the actual books and magazines I've got on my shelf. So when I was much younger, coming out of when I was starting to take it a little bit more seriously, I got a hold of Shep Payne's diorama book, which is great, and it's got a whole load of different subjects, and he would build all sorts of things, whether it be armor or it be aircraft. He even build like vintage boats, but more historical boats, and using figure modelling and all of that to make sort of box dioramas. I started collecting the Tamiya model magazine from the early 2000s. I think very late 2000 is my first one. So again, that's bringing back that nostalgia, and it's a real key point for me, that nostalgia that keeps bringing me back. It doesn't mean I necessarily want to build the older kits. It's more about building a modern representation of what that nostalgia is representing. So using the Linden and all that sort of thing, I've mentioned as well, very heavily armor based in my history, although I love aircraft. So Tony Greenland's Panzer Modeling Masterclass book was a key addition for me when I was younger. I'd always look through the gallery at the back, and every single time I'd see those images, it would be, oh, I want to build one of them, or I want to build one of them. And they'd look like the best models I'd ever seen. And it's interesting now to look back, as I sort of look at it more with a critical eye, you can see overspray, you can see some things aren't as tight as I once remember. But the model as a whole sells an image that I'm well up for, and it's what I'm sort of aiming at. So a lot of those things can bring us back. And it's interesting what it is that actually does capture you. For a lot of us now, I guess, because there's a lot more military shows going on, certainly in the UK, be it air shows or shows where there's actually armour and vehicles, all of that can really kick off. Getting a model is almost the natural progression of going to one of these shows, and often they're sold there as well. So it links back around. Leafing through these books and all of that brings back the idea of getting those models. And even so, I have actually gone for some vintage models as well to kind of recapture it. Some of the older Talieri kits, thinking, oh, could I either build it just as it is, in a sort of homage to the nostalgia, or actually just try and improve it and see what we can turn it into. And it's not just memories. Like I'm saying, these books give you the images as well. And there's also reference photos. So it's not just the models. It's also looking through some, I've got quite a vast reference books and library now. And often I'll go through them and I'll just find that picture that's just perfect. Whether it's the wing leader books, for instance, for aircraft. I mean, some of the shots you get in there of Spitfires and 109s from the Battle of Britain era, or going on later into different aircraft. They've got all sorts, a whole range of them. Albeit, I've mentioned before, I've got the Zaloga books, which is Armoured Attack, Armoured Thunderbolt, and Armoured Victory, 1945. And the images in those for Allied armour is just... every single one is just, it's just great. You know, it just really captures the imagination. So that's really good for getting a lot of the armoured stuff. And also, you know, ideas for dioramas, you know, a knocked out tank in a field, or weathering options as well. When you see really battered aircraft or tanks, you know, it's always these that make good subjects. So that's where inspiration can come from. And again, that's linking us back to turning that into a classic, not only generally, but in our own minds as well. And it's an amazing thing how that can be created, just with the vividness and actually sort of going into the hobby with an open mind. It's amazing how that links back. And this can then lead us on into actually learning more about the history. So I do like to link how scale modelling and the history is coming together. I mean, take this as an example. You could start by thinking, I've seen a picture, I want to build a Messerschmitt Bf 109. Then you think, right, well, what version is it? I'd like to do an E3 in Russia. And then you go, oh, well, that's not as easy as it seems, because it's not easy to actually find that there was an E3 in Russia, so maybe it didn't happen. So what were the Messerschmitts in Russia? And you go, oh, and then you get, oh, well, there was a few E7s, but also there's the beginning of the F2 coming in. So do I want to get into that? And then you maybe buy a book, or you get down a rabbit hole online, and then you start to go, oh, well, the E1 was used here, the E3 was used there, the E4 was there, the E7. And then you get the F2, and then you go, oh, actually, I've seen this photo of an F2 in Barbarossa in 1941, quite late on. Oh, I think I'll build one of those. So now you've gone from just thinking a Messerschmitt 109 is a Messerschmitt 109 to realizing there's E and F variants. And then you look a bit further and see there's Gs and G6. And on it goes. So you're starting to break down the fact that a 109 isn't just a plane. It's got this lifespan through the war, and it's got these variants that are changing, and the bits that are changing, it usually is the engine, shown by the cowling. I mean, from my point of view, I like the early versions, the sort of Jumo Schmitz, as they're called, with the Jumo engine, which is kind of A through to D. And then there's the beginning of the E, which is the one kind of around Battle of Britain in that era. Sort of nudging out as they start to go into Russia, or there were a few E's flying about here and there, but it's much more the F coming in then. And then that quickly turns in, if you jump through a few years, it turns into G's in Russia and all over the Western Front as well. So that kind of helps you learn through the building process, and it's surprising how that then leans on to something else. You might actually then become very interested in the 109 itself, and you start joining Facebook groups and buying books, and before you know it, you buy a mountain of kits and you only ever build one. But that's part of the joy of the hobby as well. There's an interesting point as well with maybe overlooked icons. You know, these are historically significant subjects, but they might not actually become a classic of, well, they might not become a classic in the historical world, but in the hobby world, they usually find their niche, and there's often a kit for them. So if we take something like the IL-2 Sturmovik, you know, one of the most important aircraft on the Eastern Front from the Soviet side, and, you know, it ticks all the boxes that we said before. It was dreaded by the Germans. They'd see it coming over, and they'd think, oh, there's nothing they could use to knock it out early on, or it was very difficult to actually shoot out of the sky, like a flying tank. But you wouldn't say it's a classic. It wouldn't be in your sort of top 10. It would be further down the list. But it doesn't mean that it should be. And it's often overlooked by modellers if you compare it to like a Mustang or a P-51. And legacy doesn't always guarantee popularity. Sometimes it's about how that legacy is actually marketed and visualised as well. So nostalgia can actually eclipse historical importance just by the fact of how it captures the imagination. So is it actually nostalgia that makes a subject classic? Or is it the legacy? Who knows? Maybe it is actually both. And maybe that's, you know, what makes this hobby so interesting as well, is the fact that we can actually take memories, take images, take nostalgic ideas, things that we grew up on, and actually end up with history at the end of it. I think that's, it's a fantastic part of the hobby. And next, segment 3. So this is history in plastic. When events make the model. And in this part of the episode, we're going to look at how history itself defines an actual model subject's appeal. Some kits do become classics, not just because of how they look, but because of actually where they were, be it Normandy, Midway, Stalingrad. Sometimes it's actually the moment in time that makes the model. And we can surround that to the actual subject that we're building. We can bring that in. I often will have something like a documentary or a podcast or an audiobook going along with the subject that I'm actually building. Often I like to, around the June time, I like to build along with a couple of Barbarossa subjects, you know, to tie in with when that was beginning. I get very interested in that era. Same with Normandy, or be it around the kind of winter period, I do start thinking about Stalingrad and other aspects. You know, you hear about anniversaries coming up, and it's in the actual media, and you're seeing this stuff happening, and it kind of drives you and thinks, okay, how is that event sort of affecting the model I'm building? If we take Normandy, I mean, let's start with Normandy for aircraft. What does it immediately bring to life? It's those distinctive black and white invasion stripes, often described as being hastily hand-painted on the wings or the fuselages. You can almost see it, you know, the D-Day Mustang or Typhoon with its stripes getting ready to go, and it's an absolute classic. What was happening on the ground? Well, we've got the Sherman DD tanks with the flotation screens. Some of them made it onto the beaches, and coming on up the beaches very kind of laboured and coming out of the water, and heading on inland. That really conjures up an idea. Then you've got Hobart's funnies. So if you've got Churchill AVREs and all of that sort of thing, with those engineering beasts with a crocodile or the bobbin, that sort of stuff. You've also got the landing craft and ducks, the DUKWs. And you've even got the figure side of things with infantry scaling the beaches and all of that sort of thing, trying to make it up. That's what Normandy evokes, and you've got all of that coming behind it as you start to move inland. That whole scene really captures the imagination, and these events can really make the model. If we take the Pacific Theatre, with the carrier wars and turning points, it's the classic is the Battle of Midway with the Zeros and Wildcats fighting each other, aircraft carriers being totally destroyed, and it changing that side of the war completely in one battle. Japan's naval air power was pretty much gone after the Battle of Midway, and at the start, you know, it was looking it could go either way. So building Midway era kits can, even if it's just a plane or even a ship, if you're into that, it's actually, you're modelling an era that is showing a diverse sort of shift in the balance of power. And it's the start of the carrier war, where you know battleships are now no longer needed after this battle. It really defines the era of the aircraft carrier, and it's amazing that you can get in that mode just by building a model. If we move ourselves over to the Eastern Front, cool ourselves down a bit, you know, you've got a kind of modelling. It's different over there. It's more about the struggle, and it conjures up an atmosphere. It always personally captures my mind. You know, the Eastern Front is a real period of the Second World War that does hold me interest-wise, whether it be Stalingrad. You know, you can do dioramas of sniper duels, rubble. It's very gritty, it's very hard, difficult fighting, and it's a period as well that was disastrous, again, for turning points. Pretty much the end of Germany's war out of Stalingrad. Again, it's, especially if you look at a wider view of World War II, you've got Stalingrad and you've got the fall of the North African Front more or less at the same time, more or less with 250,000 men lost on in both areas. That's a lot of troops to lose in one go. Very difficult to see how Germany can make a push for the Second World War after this period going into 1943. Or scaling out, you know, you've got the classic Kursk, which is the massive tank battle, but also a huge battle in the air as well at the same time, which is often overlooked. And the machines that are over there as well, whether it be Panzer IVs, KV tanks, T-34s, later on Tigers, Panthers. We've talked about Kursk, the elephant turning up, all sorts of mad stuff as well goes on over there. You get one-offs on the German side of things. You get amazing resilience from the Soviets and pushing in quite antique-looking tanks, whether it be the lumbering T-28s or the T-35s, taking these brand-new tanks, T-34s, in 1941, but then being absolutely destroyed because they've been deployed in a poor way. It's amazing how much can actually be tied together there. It's always gritty, and it does bring the storytelling, you know, especially putting a tank or an aircraft on a base set in the Eastern Front. It always gives that look. Pretty obvious where it is. Aside from that, there's tech-driven classics. So there's the aspect where the war's actually greatly moving on quite fast, and you get the jet age, especially from the German side of view. So you've got ME-262, this is the world's first operational jet fighter, and it's very sleek, advanced looking shape, and the anecdotes of when the Allies first come in contact with it, how it's got that kind of myth again behind it. Very quickly realised by the Allied pilots that if you just wait until it comes into land, it becomes a very vulnerable aircraft. So that, you know, that was a way of taking it out. Or V2 rockets, late war German jets, and the defence of the Reich. It really conjures up an image. You know, all this has a part to play of what might have been in that kind of fascination. I mean, it's far too little, too late. But also a lot of it, if you look at it, you know, some of these things are held together almost with a wing and a prayer. Some of these jet fighters, you know, they're more about, I don't know if I'd want to have gone up in a comet, put it like that. Aside from that as well, on the ground, like I said before, I think I said it in the last podcast about being in a Matilda 1 and 5 years later a Pershing drives past. Same again on the Soviet side, you know, you've got T-26s at the beginning of the war, and at the end of the war you've got IS-2s. I mean, it's just staggering to see these things. You know, it's these kits and subjects that, you know, it's not just for their aesthetics that you're building them. It's what they represent as well. And especially on the tech-driven side, you know, the beginning of the jet age and all of that is bringing in this dawn of the Cold War thinking as well. It's that idea of we're pushing on through now into different aspects. You know, propellers are starting to go and we're getting jets come in. It builds a very different picture. And I guess this leads on to one question that's worth asking. You know, do we build these subjects because they're important, or is it because they just look cool? That can be an aspect to it as well. You know, the Tiger One as a tank looks like the idea that most people think of when they see a tank. It's got a nice look to it, but I think it was actually more feared than effective. I think it's what captures the imagination. You know, the T-34 is boxy, simple, probably the best tank of the war, certainly built in vast numbers. Why are we building those? Are we building it because we like the how it looks, or are we building it because it's iconic? I like the Swordfish, for instance, you know, which is a biplane relic that, you know, almost doesn't have a place in the Second World War just by looking at it. But it did cripple the Bismarck. It did knock out the Italian fleet, Taranto. And it's a story behind it that makes it unforgettable. And we can even deepen that with thinking about like the Westland Lysander, which is local to me in the southwest of England. The funny little aircraft, it's dropping SOE agents into occupied France. You know, it's going against all of this. All of these amazing planes and technology are there, yet Westland Lysanders are landing in France, dropping SOE agents, which is creating this whole other story as part of the Second World War. And it's can then make you think, well, actually, the Lysander on the face of it looks a bit odd, but maybe I do want to build one. All of that can tie these things together, and it is it's definitely worth thinking about. Now, I think I've hammered home nostalgia, and we've also looked at legacy and how real-world history gives certain subjects weight. A side I don't hear very much mentioned about, and I think it's extremely important, is how incredibly powerful pop culture is to this aspect. And this might not have been a thing a few years ago, but, you know, there's a lot going on these days which may have actually... It's easy to not see it if you're in some aspects of modelling and you're not being exposed to these things. So if we take Hollywood's impact, you know, actual film, whereas a lot of us do start with history books and that sort of thing, there is a whole generation coming through of these more modern movies. We've all seen them, and I hear a lot of people sort of mentioning about how there's inaccuracies and things like that. But if you're on the younger end, or you've just sort of getting back into the hobby, it can be these films and these series that will actually bring you in as well. I mean, think about Fury. That was a real film for me, I think. I felt like it totally changed the game. You can look at the film and critique it all you want from a historical point of view, but what it's actually done for the hobby, I think, is unprecedented before that, but I think it's happened quite a lot afterwards. You know, whereas most war films focus on infantry, or they might focus on aircraft and things like this, this was a mainstream Hollywood movie that put a tank right at the front. Front and centre, you've got an M4 Easy 8 Sherman. And, you know, more than that, you've got this kind of idea as well. I remember when it was coming out around the time, they were talking about how they liked to make sure everything was quite accurate. There's all manner of M4 Shermans through this, and as you're going on through the film, all of a sudden what pops up is the actual only, still currently I think, working, certainly original, Tiger One in existence. And it's gone up from Bovington, and there it is in the film. Yes, it's probably the wrong variant for Normandy. I can't think of any earlies that I've seen that were being used in Normandy, although I did see one popped up around Arnhem, so... You know, they were still about. But that one definitely wouldn't have been there. It probably should have had a lot of other things with it. It should have had the Zimmerit and all of that. Maybe should have been a late, etc., etc. But to see it on the screen, coming at a group of Shermans that, again, it probably wouldn't have done in reality. Why would it? But charging through on the screen, it done half make you think, I want to build an Easy 8 Sherman, I want to build an M4 Sherman, and I want to build a Tiger. And I think that happened for a lot of people. And, you know, what happens next? Tamiya has an Easy 8 in their catalogue. Italieri has the actual Fury kit in all but, I think they even call it Fury, I can't remember, but certainly has all the bits and bobs that are in the film. And there was a wave of these kits being built. Like I said, actually specific boxings. There was even a resin figure set that came out as well, which had the whole crew from the film. So suddenly you've got modelers, never built an aircraft or a tank, and they're in hobby shops, they're looking, and these armor kits are what is being sold, and it's bringing a whole generation into modelling. And to keep hammering it home, you know, does that mean it's made the M4 Easy 8 Sherman a classic? I don't think we would have seen that coming before. There's TV series and immersion as well, so an inspiration coming from that. And we all know about Saving Private Ryan, which is another classic film, more from my era, I guess, as I was growing up. That's the one that I wanted to watch. We got Band of Brothers, The Pacific. All of this gives you, tends to be a lot less vehicle heavy. It's carrying you through the narrative, but it's putting you in the situation. So you're seeing with Band of Brothers, you've got C-47s, Shermans, half tracks, and German armor as well breaking through. The Pacific is LVTs and landing craft. It's showing you that Pacific side. You've got aircraft again. You've also got the naval side, but there's a lot of other things as well. You know, let's not forget the older films and TV series. So The Longest Day, A Bridge Too Far, Big Red One, you've got Das Boot and all this sort of thing that are now being redone as actual series as well. So you've got U-boats coming in and all that sort of thing. It gives you context, and it places the vehicle, the aircraft, the ship, whatever it is, it puts it in the story and it gives it context. And then suddenly that kit isn't just, you know, a piece of plastic on the shelf. It's something that you're wanting to build for a reason. You're driven, and it's linking us back in to that idea. Now, most important of all, I think, for recent times has got to be video games, which if you told me 10 years ago, or it might have been around 10 years ago, but a bit further ago, I've got to that period in my life now where I think I'm just constantly think I'm 25, even though I keep getting older. World of Tanks and War Thunder. That's the two that hit me. And I know there's obviously there's DCS World, there's a lot of flight simulators, there's IL-2, I think, Sturmovik or something like that. There's lots of computer games that have come out. But World of Tanks and War Thunder have really caught a certain generation, and because it's very accessible. The game's actually free. You've got in-game bits and bobs you can actually buy to upgrade, but the actual game is free, and if you want to grind through it, you can just play it for free. And I personally have gone through both of these. I prefer War Thunder because it's a little bit more realistic, but World of Tanks is probably a more fun game. But War Thunder also has the aircraft. It's also brought in the naval aspect as well. I think also, to be fair to World of Tanks, I think there's also a world of aircraft and a world of warships. That has brought in so many people to this hobby. I think it's worth making a point. And it's, again, now what's making that into a classic? There's a wonderful thing that's come out of this. It'll be the next section. But let's just stay within this. Is games aren't, they're not a passive thing. It's not like a book, you know, they're interactive. You are actually driving the tank or you're flying the aircraft, and you actually then become familiar. Now, I've done this. When you're flying in the aircraft, you can change the view to be in the cockpit. You can look around. You've got, and they're actually pretty accurate. They look like a FW190 cockpit when I'm in it. It looks like my model. And it makes you think, cool, I'd actually like to build one of these, because the amount of time some of these people are playing these games, you are into it for a long, long time. Because to grind through, you to get the points and stuff to actually level up to get the next vehicle or the next aircraft, you've got to spend a long time in it. So you get very familiar with it. And then there's forums talking about how these work, because the games are quite accurate. They're actually designed in a way that the vehicles or the aircraft work. So, I mean, I've been playing a game when no matter what I do, every time I go to turn the aircraft, I get shot down. It's because I'm using the aircraft incorrectly. I should be, apparently, according to the forums, I should be going up higher and coming down on aircraft to try and shoot them that way. And as soon as I did that, I scored and survived better in the game. But I do come away from it thinking about FW190s, because that's what I'm flying. And I'm thinking, well, I think I've got a couple of them in the stash, and I do love that aircraft. Now, companies like Italieri have obviously jumped on this in recent years, and they've got branded kits, and they're tied to these games. And they often come with actually bonus in-game content. Usually the box art features the game art. It's not actually, so we're talking about box art now. You're seeing what you see in the game, so you're linking that, you've got the context there, and it's exactly as they appear on the screen, which makes it very easy for someone to, you know, almost be on their computer, go in the shop, see the box, think, yep, I'll buy that, especially if you actually have in-game bonuses as well. What's most important that's come out of this, and I must admit, it's more this is more tanks, this is held into, it hasn't really caught on with aircraft, is the idea of a meme tank. And I think that's all come from these games, because it's younger people, who I think is fantastic, it's not always younger people. I do think it's fantastic how humans have we've got this wonderful resource called the internet, and the amount of time we spend sending stupid pictures of absolute nonsense to each other. And you'll see a picture that is the most obscure niche thing, but if you know what it is and you're on the other end of it, it becomes the funniest thing you've seen that day. Now, to extend that, you know, there's the idea of an actual meme tank, and these are vehicles like the KV-2, for instance, or the TOG-2, or giant experimental VK tanks as well, the VK series of German tanks. They're not necessarily famous in history before this, but they do become iconic in the gaming circles, and suddenly you get niche prototypes, or you get very odd vehicles. I mean, the KV-2, I don't remember that being a massive interest, but certainly out on the back end of it, it's a meme tank, because it does look so silly and it didn't really do very much in the grand scheme of things. It's captured the imagination, and it's not because of what they did, it's because of how they feel, you know, to the player, and how they look. You know, they can look silly, they can have a great big turret, or they can be far too big for what they were designed to do, or they can be a little bit useless. And that's part of the beauty of this. And you even get then museums, for instance, come in on the back of this, especially Bovington, I think, have exploited this incredibly well with their Tiger 1. You know, it's being known the world over for having the only running Tiger. It must have brought hundreds of people through the doors. And that's a lovely bit of marketing off the back of it. And they've even got a gaming section in there. When you go in there, there is an area set up. And I don't know which it is. I should check. But it might be both. But I think they're tied in with wargaming.net, I think. And all of this then can take you down the road of it leading to what if builds or alternate schemes that you know from the game, and now you're starting to actually rival some of the old guard who are in there saying, you know, German Grey is meant to be this shade. Well, you know, it doesn't necessarily matter, because if you're trying to build a vehicle from the game and the game is what you're relating it to, there's nothing wrong with that. So is that becoming now an on-ramp for the hobby? And I think it's interesting. Have we gone from thinking classics and box art and all of this? Is it now what you're seeing in videos and games and in actual media? So a film like Fury, or a TV show like The Band of Brothers, or a game like War Thunder or World of Tanks, can it be a gateway? I think it really importantly is a way into the hobby. And I think you might not have ever cared about tanks until you see the Tiger, you know, crest a hill in the movie, and it captures that imagination. Or you've flown a Spitfire in-game. It's about then trying to make that into getting a 3D representation of that and building it and thinking, then actually coming out with an extra hobby. Dare I say, is better for getting you away from the TV. For me, it doesn't bother me. You know, doesn't matter how you get here. As far as I'm concerned, the more people in the hobby, the better. And all of these gateways into it are fantastic things. And it's really good to get that they're out there, they're accessible, and they're being exploited by new hobbyists. So it's a great thing. Now let's hope they can then move into the history. From what I'm seeing on forums, and well, I say forums, it's mainly Reddit and all that sort of thing. These gamers are very quick to find out the real history behind a lot of this. And there's a lot of YouTube channels as well that are showing the real history behind it from the point of view of, say, a meme tank. It's actually what the video's about, but when we're finding out why that tank is a meme and what it ended up being. I think just to round out, you know, what's going to be a future classic and where is the hobby going? It's an interesting question. What's a future classic going to be? I do wonder how long the Second World War is going to hold its interest. You know, the further we get out from it, how strong is that grip on the hobby going to be? You know, we've just gone past a lot of the 80-year anniversaries, and most of the major events now have gone through their 80s. Now they're going into the 85s, and we're starting them. You know, when we start hitting the 90s and the 95 anniversaries, or the 100-year mark, is it still going to be have as strong an influence as it does today? Is modelling going to change? I don't know. Is the Tiger tank going to be as impressive in 10 or 15, 20 years? Similarly with the Sherman or the Mustang, or are we going to move to something more modern? You know, is it time for new classics? Are we going to get Cold War era starting to come in, or more modern aircraft like Tomcats or MiGs and Phantoms? Is Vietnam going to start capturing it, and we're going to move on through the period, or up into Desert Storm and that sort of thing? Or is it going to be even current conflicts and things going on are going to become what people are modelling more? I personally believe that as we go on through, it's going to stay very much overwhelmingly in the Second World War. Certainly for the next period, for the next sort of 5 years, I think we're going to be right in that period. And now what I'm saying is the Second World War being the most popular modelled period. But after that, I don't know. It's difficult to see. We could get civilian vehicles, car modelling, motorbikes, that sort of thing, starting to get more of a pickup. It's difficult. But with the idea of World of Tanks and War Thunder, I think that captures a whole new generation and plonks them right back in the middle of the Second World War. And I think it's gonna stay like that for a bit. I'd struggle to see how a different era is gonna kick off and bring people into making that the new period. And also, one of the real things I worry about is what perfection is. We're getting very close, from what I can tell. Edward aircraft, when they come out, the rivet lines and the panel line detail is stuff I could have only dreamt about a few years ago. It does make you wonder. And then you got people like companies like Qatari coming in and sort of changing the game again. Now we're getting a whole load of releases in 1/32nd, and they're absolute almost scale replicas of the real aircraft. You got Tamiya, who seems to go from strength to strength, making kits more accessible, because the thing that Tamiya does is puts it in kind of every shop. Most model shops have Tamiya, so you start to get that idea as well. And this incredible detail with accessibility and ease of build, with rivets and the fit and the engineering, it's making me think, are we going to have everything like that sort of 10 or 15 years down the line? It is a wonder. I wonder if we may have reached the peak kit or not. I don't know. It's nice to get the odd surprise. For me, personally, I've mentioned it before and I'll mention it again, is the Gecko Models announcing the Matilda 1 really rounds everything off for me. I'm struggling to come up with an idea of what we actually need added. One last thing that's important to mention on this topic that I've got myself into here is obviously the role of 3D printing. You know, where's that going to come in? We've started to hear that now. It's starting to come into the narrative. What's 3D printing going to do and how's it going to change the hobby? I think short term, certainly the next 5 to 10 years, I don't think we're going to get kits being 3D printed kits. We just download them and print them. After dabbling in 3D printing, I can tell you it's certainly not plug and play just quite yet. It's pretty simple, but it's not plug and play. But it's starting to revolutionize the extra detailing. What can be done by individuals and companies to add extra parts to kits and add that extra detail. And it is allowing the modeler now, if you've got the skills to get your CAD program up and running, you don't need to think about having a factory to produce your new kit. You can produce a fully 3D printed kit. It has its own limitations, it has its own problems, but it is possible. And with skill, all of those limitations and problems can be worked out in the modeling aspect, and you're ending up getting models that wouldn't exist if it wasn't for 3D printing. But me personally, I don't think in the next 5 or 10 years we're going to see a change. Maybe in 20, could well be definitely outside of the next 20 years. But I think it's an interesting idea to think about, and it's something to take on board. So, just to round off, what are we going to be calling a classic subject in 2035? Is it going to be a Spitfire or Sherman? Or will it be a Leopard 2? An F-35. Who knows? Is it going to be the next generation of iconic aircraft and tanks? Are they going to be what's being built on people's benches? I don't know. We may even still be sat here debating what the best Spitfire Mark 9 kit is. Now, hopefully that's been of interest. A little bit of a ramble with actually some solid content now here in episode 2. More how I want the podcast to be going forward. I'd really like to hear from you. So again, do get in contact with all the information that's in the description box below. You can send me an email, leave a comment down below, and let's get the conversation started. I'd love to hear from you and what you think about a lot of the stuff I've just mentioned there, and where you think the hobby's going or where your hobby is. What are you building? Are you building more modern kits these days, or are you sticking with old favourites? Are you caught up in nostalgia? Does that affect you? Is it box art, that sort of thing? Where do you think the future of the hobby is as well? It's an interesting subject to think about. But that's it for episode 2, so thanks for listening, and hopefully you enjoyed it. If you haven't already, do consider subscribing, share this around, let your friends know as well. The more listeners we can get involved, the better. If you want to help the channel or the podcast, have a look in the description box below. There's a couple of links there. We've got a Patreon page, and there's a couple of ways you can help us out. In the next episode, we're going to be having a historical look at a single subject, and we're going to focus down on into the details. So we'll see how that goes. Wish me luck. Maybe these books are going to come in handy to help me through that. But until then, happy modelling, and keep building those classic subjects.